There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
The Duchess of Cambridge is lending a hand to bring awareness to Children's Mental Health Week in the UK. And to discuss the topic further here in the UAE, we're joined by Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Good afternoon, Thuraya. How are you?
Good afternoon, Helen. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. So Children's Mental Health Week in the UK, obviously a good opportunity to talk about mental health amongst the young people in general. So Duchess of Cambridge has released a message. The soon-to-be mother of three has kicked off the week of Children's Mental Health Week by releasing this video. The theme is being ourselves, and she's working with the charity Place to Be about the importance of pupils, parents and teachers working together to support young people. Let's have a little listen.
Childhood is an incredibly important moment in our lives. It is a time when we explore our personalities, discover the potential that lies within us, and learn how we be ourselves. Our experience of the world at this early stage helps to shape who we become as adults and how we begin to feel comfortable in our own skin.
I think schools have a really important role in trying to encourage children and young people to be themselves. When I first started in year seven, I found it quite difficult to try and put forward who I was. I spent a lot of time with Place to Be, and they've taught me a lot about how I can be who I am.
When I think about what enables young people to be themselves, I think it's that team, that community around the young person, whether it's the school, the parents, the wider community, that create that environment and that setting for them to do that.
Some children will be facing tougher challenges than others, but I firmly believe that while we cannot change their circumstances, we can ensure that every child is given the best possible support to ensure they fulfil their true potential. This is best achieved when we, the adults in their lives, work together to give children the emotional strength they need to face their futures and thrive.
When my children started here, they both attended Place to Be, and I feel that attending Place to Be has helped them just realise that, you know, they are who they are, they should be comfortable in their own skin, embrace who they are, and that works for them, and so that they never feel like they're in competition with someone else.
In today's society, it is quite hard, and I feel like it's important to understand that what you see on social media shouldn't be what you think you should be.
Schools and families occupy a special position at the heart of every child's life. And that is why I'm proud to support Place to Be's work this Children's Mental Health Week. Whether we are school leaders, teachers, support staff or parents, we each have a crucial role to play. When we're open and honest with each other about the challenges we face, we can work together to ensure the children in our care have the chance to become the best versions of themselves.
So that was the Duchess of Cambridge releasing a special message to start Children's Mental Health Week in the UK. Dr. Thuraya, you are here on hand this afternoon to answer any questions and calls that come in on any subject. We're talking about children's mental health specifically in this first hour, and then grief coming up. So please do get in touch if you'd like Dr. Thuraya's help or advice. 4001 is the SMS, or give us a call 04 423 1010. So this is obviously a positive thing, Children's Mental Health Week, in terms of shining a light. Do you think it's something that's still quite neglected almost in terms of the public consciousness?
Absolutely. You know, unfortunately, when we think of the statistics, when it comes to children's mental health, we find that 70% of children that suffer from any kind of mental health disorder are actually not receiving the treatment and the interventions that they need before a sufficiently proper age. So 70%.
And why do you think that is?
Well, you know, there are so many different reasons, but definitely I would have to say by far the most important one is stigma. And then the one that comes right after that is the lack of awareness. Because most people think that, you know, children, you know, they have nothing to worry about. You know, why would anything be wrong with them? You know, like those are the kind of stigmatic statements that you'll hear people say. But unfortunately, children, just like adults, can suffer through any type of mental health disorder. And it doesn't have to be because of something in their life. Because as we know, with mental health disorders, there are also physical disorders, being there's chemistry in the brain that might be different, there's genetics that might be different. So all of these things can contribute to a child's mental health and thus, you know, leading to some sort of difficulty.
I feel like growing up, mental health wasn't really discussed in the kind of the 80s and 90s, and now I feel like it is coming into the open a little bit more. You know, according to Young Minds, around a quarter of young people have symptoms of mental ill health, and most lifelong mental health issues start before the age of 14. So it is huge, and I'm glad that it is becoming a topic of discussion. You know, just as we all have physical health, we all have mental health. And sometimes our physical health is good, and sometimes our mental health is good, and sometimes it's bad. And in both cases, it's a fact of life, and it's something that all of us will go through at some point. In terms of children, though, people, and if you do have any concerns about your child, please do text in 4001, and we'll do our best to answer any questions this afternoon with Dr. Thryer. What could people do if they are concerned about a mental or behavioural or any emotional symptoms in their child?
Well, you know, the first thing I say to most parents is try your best to not become defensive, because the first thing that happens when a parent thinks that there could be something that their child is experiencing, they automatically think that they're doing something wrong.
It's a criticism on their parenting.
Exactly. Is that, you know, they're not a good enough mother, not a good enough father. And so the first thing I say is don't think of it in a defensive way, because this has nothing to do with you. This has to do with your child. Your child is experiencing something. Whether it's real or perceived, your child is experiencing something. And so what I think the first cluster of symptoms that you want to look at is any kind of changes in your child's behavior. So this could be either sleeping more, eating more, sleeping less, eating less. I mean, any kind of changes in moods, in behaviors, aggression, irritability, all of those different types of things.
Okay, so we've actually already had a text in saying, I'm very worried about my 12-year-old daughter. She's often in tears when she comes home from school and won't open up about what's troubling her. How can I get her to tell me what's wrong, and when should I involve the school?
Well, I usually say don't involve the school when she's 12. That could get very touchy for a 12-year-old, especially because, you know, kids can be quite cruel and they'll end up making fun of her and things will actually get worse. So initially, you don't want to involve the school. You want to first build a relationship with your 12-year-old. So you can't expect your 12-year-old to open up to you if you don't have some sort of proper communication between you and that 12-year-old. And so if, you know, developing that relationship first, spending time with a 12-year-old, not necessarily always looking for the bad stuff, even looking and talking about the good things and encouraging her, and, you know, just spending quality time and building that relationship first is a good way to, like, it's a stepping stone to then having the child feel comfortable enough to open up and to talk to you.
So getting the communication lines open mm-hmm. across everything. I always remember whenever my mum wanted me to talk when I was a teenager, and I was, she's not listening. I was always quite a deceptive teenager. I was a bit naughty. But if she wanted me to have an honest discussion about things that were going on or things I was worried about, we'd always try and do something together. So, you know, go for a swim and we'd talk while we were swimming, or some kind of activity where it wasn't sitting down across a kitchen table and having a conversation, which is actually intimidating on both sides. I always felt like I was in trouble when she sat me down to have a discussion. So I think trying to, you know, ease people in is, speaking as a, you know, as a teenager who used to have a lot of these conversations, it definitely was beneficial. School age seems to be where it really seems to take off in the survey results. By the age of 16, 70% report feeling sad or anxious at least once a week, with nearly a quarter having negative feelings as much as once a day, and nearly half of all 12-year-olds are suffering from anxiety. And as we've heard, of teens feeling even more troubled. That's Bernardo's, who have done that survey conducted by YouGov. Do you think that kind of preteen, teen, is that something you guys see? You work with teenagers, Dr. Thryer. Is that something you're seeing more and more people coming in with?
Absolutely. And one of the things I see the most in the UAE is anxiety amongst teenagers. And it's not just anxiety within themselves and their surroundings, but anxiety at school. And so they have this, there seems to be this very competitive nature within the schools in Dubai. And they really pressure a lot of these kids to be the best and to sort of know their future, know everything that they're supposed to know. And so kids feel very, very anxious when it comes to things like that. And I see a lot more test anxiety, exam anxiety, assignment anxiety, or just generalized anxiety here than I have in any of the other countries that I've ever worked in.
That's really interesting. And as parents, what can we be doing to offset that pressure that's being put on by the schools? Is it a case of moving schools, perhaps, and trying to find the right fit for that child? Or do you feel like that's a problem across the academic system in the UAE?
Actually, to be honest, there was a and a letter that was sent out by a principal in a Singaporean school. And this has been, it's been going around on the internet because it's such a great letter. And it's a letter that the principal wrote to the parents of their students before the exams started. And the principal basically said, of course, I don't remember, but he basically said things like, don't stress your kids out on achieving these grades, because even amongst all of these kids, one of them is going to be an artist, one of them is going to be a dancer, one of them is going to be the entrepreneur, the businessman, one of them is going to be the engineer. It doesn't matter what they become. What matters is how they develop their confidence and their belief within themselves, and that's what's ultimately going to be the true sense of their success.
Yeah, that's what's going to carry them through life, rather
exactly.
than grades they got when they were 15 years old.
Absolutely.
We're joined in the studio this afternoon by Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist who's based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, who specialises in children and teenagers especially. So we were talking earlier about a letter that went out from a principal in Singapore that really caught your attention. I'm going to read a little bit of it. We've been talking about pressures on children and at a school age. This is what he said. Dear parents, the exams of your children are to start soon. I know you are all really anxious for your child to do well. But please do remember, amongst the students who will be sitting for the exams, there is an artist who doesn't need to understand maths. There is an entrepreneur who doesn't care about history or English literature. There's a musician whose chemistry marks won't matter. There's an athlete whose physical fitness is far more important than physics. If your child does get top marks, that's great. But if he or she doesn't, please don't take away their self-confidence and dignity from them. Tell them it's okay. It's just an exam. They are cut out for much bigger things in life. Tell them, no matter what they score, you love them and will not judge them. Please do this, and when you do, watch your children conquer the world. One exam or a low mark won't take away their dreams and talent. Please do not think that doctors and engineers are the only happy people in the world. How important to get as a parent. And I think even a student reading that and hearing that would be bolstered, I think. So that was a letter that came from a school principal in Singapore. We're talking this afternoon about children's mental health. It's Children's Mental Health Week in the UK. And we've got a little clip from Inside Out, which is one of my favourite films. It's an animated film by Pixar. And it's the story of Riley, who's moved house from the Midwest to San Francisco. And her emotions are also in the film. Joy, fear, anger, disgust and sadness. Have a little listen to this. It's Riley having dinner with her parents and all of the emotions joining them at the dinner table.
So, how was the first day of school?
It was fine, I guess. I don't know.
Do you ever look at someone and wonder, what is going on inside their head?
Did you guys pick up on that?
Sure did.
Something's wrong.
We're going to find out what's happening, but we'll need support. Signal the husband.
Harry, all the way.
Uh-oh, she's looking at us. What did she say?
What? Oh, sorry, sir. No one was listening.
Is it garbage night? We left the toilet seat up. What? What is it, woman? What?
Signal him again.
Ah, so, Riley, how was school?
Oh, you gotta be kidding me!
For this, we gave up that Brazilian helicopter pilot?
School was great, all right?
What was that? I thought you said we were gonna act casual.
Riley, is everything okay?
Sir, she just rolled her eyes at us.
All right, make a show of force. I don't want to have to put the foot down.
No. Not the foot.
Riley, I do not like this new attitude.
Oh, I'll show you attitude, old
no,
man.
No, breathe.
What is your problem? Just leave me alone.
Sir, reporting high levels of sass.
Take it to DEFCON 2.
DEFCON 2.
I don't know where this disrespectful attitude came from.
You want a piece of this, Pops?
Yeah, well, look.
Prepare the foot.
Just shut up!
Fire! That's it. Go to your room.
The foot is down. The foot is down.
Yeah! This film was really born from watching our kids grow up, which is not easy. Anyone out there who's in junior high, high school, working it out, suffering, there are days you're going to feel sad, you're going to feel angry, you're going to feel scared. That's nothing you can choose, but you can make stuff. Make films, draw, write. It'll make a world of difference.
That was a clip from Inside Out with Pete Docter, one of the writers, speaking at the end. How important can a film like that actually be for talking to your child about their emotions, Dr. Thryer?
I think that was a great movie regarding like teaching parents that, you know, although you see something from your child, it may not necessarily be exactly what they're feeling. And a lot of children, they express things like anger and irritability and hostility towards their parents, but that's not what they're feeling on the inside. So I think this movie was great for parents to see that children are actually going through a lot of internal experiences just like they would. And it's also good for children to understand their own emotions and where that comes from. So this was a great movie in that sense. However, I do feel like sometimes it sort of dumbs down the dad a bit in the sense that it makes it sound like the men aren't really good at picking up on emotions, which is not completely accurate, especially with fathers. Sometimes they can pick up on certain emotions with their kids in ways that mothers can't.
So we're talking this afternoon about children's mental health, but how, we've had a text come in that might spark something. When is it mental health problems and when is it just teenage moodiness?
So that's a hard one for me because those kind of words like moodiness, laziness, those things, I don't really believe in those words because I feel like they're just cop-outs to us actually understanding. And it gives a lot more of our own insecurities and our own fears and discomfort rather than what's actually going on. Children are moody, yes, but so are adults. So for us to say that, you know, children are moody, oh, this person's just being moody, or then blaming it at the time of the month or blaming it on the fact that they're teenagers. I mean, these kinds of things are just cop-outs. And it's us trying to stay away from really getting into topics that we may not necessarily want to hear. So I wouldn't say that at any moment, there's a child that is just moody, simply just moody, and really in that reductionist kind of perspective. But I would say that all children, whether it's a real or it's a perceived experience, for them, they're going through something.
And as a parent, you need to recognize and validate that.
Right, because ultimately, you know, and I think it goes back to what the Duchess was saying in the sense that we can't control their circumstances, but what we can do is support. And the more support we give them, the more coping strategies we teach them, the more tools we give them in their toolbox, the more likely they are to work through functionally their difficulties, and it'll lead to less likelihood of developing mental health disorders.
And also going back to the stigma, you know, you don't feel ashamed about physical health. So if, you know, if you broke your leg or you have a sore throat, but there's so much stigma attached to mental illness that by talking about it more and making sure that support is known to be there for them, hopefully we'll be able to get conversations going a little bit further. But how would you know if your child's problems are serious, especially at a younger age where they're perhaps not able to articulate really what they're feeling?
See, I think the first thing that we have to define is the word serious. So what do you mean by serious? In terms of, some parents think that seriousness means, oh my God, we have to go to a psychologist, or we have to go to a psychiatrist or medication, you know, and then they start to really worry. But the seriousness comes in from the fact that it's affecting the child. And at that moment, that's serious. So if it's affecting your child, then you need to step in. It doesn't have to hit. It doesn't have to be a black or white situation. Either it's A-OK or it's absolutely catastrophic at home. And it doesn't have to hit that point before you say, oh, OK, I need to take care of my child right now. So it's important to just recognize what's affecting your child. And it could just be in that day something serious happened. And talking through it will make it go away, or at least minimize its effect on your child. So don't take anything for granted when it comes to your children, because ultimately whatever they're experiencing may not be something big to you because you're an adult and you're thinking from an adult perspective, but to that child it might be catastrophic, and it's important to talk through it with them.
You talked about perhaps something happening at home, and also about children's mental health being affected by things like chemical imbalances and genetics. But can an event like a death in the family or illness in a parent, financial problems, divorce, obviously a very common issue, can events trigger mental health problems in children?
Of course. I mean, there are many different environmental scenarios that can trigger a mental health disorder, but ultimately they're not causes. So like we mentioned before, there's genetics, and then there's the biology of the brain, as well as, you know, personality factors, thought patterns, behavioral patterns. All of those things are contribute to the causes of mental health disorders. However, everything that happens in our life may be a trigger. So definitely things like divorce, things like a loss of a parent, things like a move from one country to another, all of these things can contribute, but not necessarily necessarily cause mental health disorders.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back. I'm Helen Farmer and this is Dubai Today. We're here live in the Dubai Eye studio with you until 2 o'clock. I'm joined this afternoon by Dr. Thraya, clinical psychologist, and we are talking about children's mental health. If you would like any advice or have questions for Dr. Thraya, do get in touch 4001 or you can give us a call 04-423-1010. We've had one text come in saying, good afternoon, my daughter's 10 years old and is having severe nail psoriasis and also coming back upset from kids in school bullying her. She also seems to have some hair for alopecia. How can I make her happier when she leaves home? And does Dr. Thraya see younger children?
You know, it's really hard to take on that responsibility of your child and say that, you know, there's really something that you can do to make her completely happy when she leaves home, because it's very difficult, you know, especially with something like psoriasis or alopecia. At this moment, what I would say is get the parents, get the school involved, because sometimes schools can be very helpful in the sense that they'll allow your child to wear a headband so she can cover up certain areas that might be thinning in where the hair is, or maybe putting on nail polish, things like that. So allowing her a few things that they don't necessarily allow other kids to do. Also having the school maybe educate the kids that are around her in her grade about what alopecia is or what psoriasis is, because I'm sure they would never do that if it had been something that they know, like cancer or leukemia or anything like that. So educating those kids at school might be helpful as well. But try your best to not discuss it too much with her, because when it becomes a focus, that's all she thinks of. So try to get her to feel happy and proud in different ways, things that she does really well, either skill sets or even other parts of her body that she feels happy with or she feels very proud of. Like, highlight those, have her, you know, really focus on her self-confidence in different aspects, so that doesn't become the focus of who she is and part of her identity, rather than just something that she has on the external.
And do you think coming to see a counselor or a psychologist would be helpful?
I mean, I think in these kinds of cases, it doesn't hurt at all, you know, but I would say talk to her, talk to your daughter, because ultimately sometimes children might feel a lot more confident with things but we are actually the ones that are nervous for them. So in that sense, ask your daughter if she'd like to talk to someone, and if she can, then definitely.
And Dr. Sabine, that works alongside you at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, could perhaps be helpful for
yes.
that age group.
Yes.
Okay, so if you've got any questions for Dr. Thraya, get in touch at 4001 or text us, or 404-423-1010. We're talking about children's mental health this afternoon. Some of the statistics, Dr. Thraya, are really quite scary. An overwhelming majority of 12 to 16 year olds in England think it would be helpful if there was a counsellor at their school to talk to. And I'm a firm believer in counselling for all ages, whereas I think in the UA perhaps there are school counsellors a little bit more common. People citing the main causes of stress being school, their future, problems at home, being bullied, their weight, and of course social media. It's been an issue for 11% people worrying about getting enough likes or responses on social media, or 15% saying they've been troubled by something they've seen on social media. This is obviously something we're experiencing more and more in the UAE. Are you getting teenagers coming to you worried about that aspect of their lives?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Things like, of course, like we mentioned before, school related issues, stress about their future, social media, need for approval, the fear of what we call FOMO, the fear of missing out, you know, either on social events or on topics that the other kids at school could talk about. Like, those kinds of things are very, very difficult for a lot of the students here.
And how are mental illnesses diagnosed in young children and teens?
So actually the diagnosis is pretty much the same as it is with adults for most of the disorders, but of course not all. Usually what will happen is the parents will either take the child to a clinical psychologist or to a psychiatrist, and they will get the diagnosis based on the child's symptomology. So, you know, a lot of people are worried about the idea or the term or the label of the diagnosis. And ultimately, really, the diagnosis is just for the psychologist and for the psychiatrist to know how to, like, know the proper treatment plan for that individual. It's really not, because that's what, like, society should label you Lazarou how you should label yourself. People are not depressed. They have depression. This is external to who they are. And it doesn't signify their identity, and it doesn't even change who they are as individuals. So the diagnosis is really a part of our treatment plan as professionals, as mental health professionals. And from the diagnosis, we have different avenues of treatments. So, of course, there is a possibility of medication, but if not, then just psychotherapy, proper interventions in the person's life, different aspects that might help the individual move forward.
So there are treatments other than medication, if that's something that's concerning parents.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of my clients that I see, I automatically ask them, do you want to be on medication or do you prefer to not even consider medication? And some of them will say, well, look, I've tried medication before, or I know somebody who's tried medication, it's really helped them, so I'd like to try it as well as doing the therapy. And then others will say, I don't want to touch medication and I would rather try this naturally first, and if after a few months it's not working, then I'll think of the medication. So,
and how does medication affect young children as opposed to teens and adults?
So obviously there are certain medications that we don't give to younger children just because it's a lot more dangerous for them, but certain medications are possible for younger children, and they are not detrimental or harmful to them at all. And all psychiatrists should know the medications that are appropriate for younger children, and they would never prescribe medication that is inappropriate for a younger child.
So it's about working alongside the experts, obviously, talking.
Yes, of course.
Because children do not have a say, really, in how they want to be treated if they're under a certain age. You know, you as an adult, you're the one acting on their behalf with best interests. So if you've got any questions for Dr. Rai, please do get in touch, 4001, or you can give us a call, 04 423 1010. It is Children's Mental Health Awareness Week in the UK. And we found an interesting article about the five things every child needs. Can you guess what they are? Here you go. I'll give you a clue. The first one, to be loved. Is that a pretty obvious one? It's that feeling of love. Belonging, to be heard, to have meaning. So I think it's maybe feeling a bit more connected to your child as a person rather than just as your child, and seeing that personality trait can be really, really helpful. Looking more locally, an article that was in the National just earlier this week, mental health care for Dubai's youth, too little, too late, say experts. A study of youngsters in Dubai suggests that early intervention will shape happier adults. And so the first report into mental health for children in Dubai, it's found that many youngsters are not receiving help early enough to give them the best chance of living a normal life. Dr. Rai, you're nodding. This seems...
Yes, and like I mentioned before, you know, the statistic that I mentioned in the beginning of the show is coming from the UK, but it's absolutely accurate for across the world. 70% of these children are not receiving the proper interventions that they need at a proper age. Usually parents will either deny or they'll ignore or they don't know until it's too late, or it's a lot harder to work through rather than catching it a lot sooner.
Eating disorders were the most common mental health issue in young girls, while boys were most likely to have autism or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Now, eating disorders, really interesting at this time of year. It's topical. It's eating disorder week in Canada, I believe. Are you seeing many eating disorders come through the clinic, Dr. Thurai?
Definitely, yes. Mostly amongst younger teenage girls. There's actually been a lot of studies done in the UAE, from anywhere from Sharjah to Abu Dhabi, done mainly by Dr. Justin Thomas, about different eating disorders and body self-image as well, and how girls look at themselves. And, you know, the statistics are quite scary, because we find statistics like 42% of first to third grade girls and 81% of 10-year-old girls are scared of being fat.
Wow.
And these are their words, scared of being fat. I want to be thin. I'm scared of being fat. And you know, there was a study that was done in the UK on 2,000 children. That they found these 2,000 children that received treatment for eating disorders in the UK, hospitalized treatment, and 600 of them were under the age of 13. 197 of them were between the ages of 5 and 9.
Oh my God.
I mean, when you really think of that number, like it's quite hard to fathom that a 5-year-old would be considering their weight and their you know, their body image and what they look like to other people. And so obviously a lot of that comes not just from internal from the individual internally, but also from the environment that the child is living in. So things like the parents, what the parents say, and it might be something so innocent in the parent's perspective. Things like, oh, you're looking so chubby today, things like that. And it might be as a joke, but a child, depending on the child, they might internalize that and take that to a completely different level. And eating disorders are really difficult because eating disorders are so hard. You know, as a psychologist, when I think of different disorders that are, you know, that are categorized, I think definitely that between anorexia and bulimia, it's some of the most or two of the most difficult disorders to treat.
And why is that?
Well, with individuals who suffer with anorexia, for instance, they have such a big fear of losing, of gaining weight, and they lose weight so quickly, and that their brain automatically starts to distort their actual image. So when they're looking in the mirror, they're seeing something completely different, and it's really hard to change that. I mean, when I was in Canada, I worked with an organization called ANEB, which is like anorexia nervosa and bulimia, and I worked with support groups for women who suffered with anorexia and bulimia. And I had one client, I'll never forget her, she had suffered with anorexia for 55 years and gosh. she had been at least 70 at the time that I had seen her. So 55 years, I mean, this is, and it's not uncommon. There are so many people when anorexia is a part of a person's life, it becomes such a difficult thing to work through. So it's really important for parents to be cognizant of their child's eating habits, as well as, obviously you don't want to helicopter your kids when they're eating, but you want to be cognizant of signs, symptoms, as well as, you know, be careful not to say things to your children that might instigate or trigger any kind of, you know, fear of what they look like. And I think a big part of that has to do with social media that we had been discussing before. And that's where a lot of the kids are getting so anxious, because when you look at social media now, if it's not the models that you're staring at, it's like everybody on social media needs to be fit. Needs to have that, like,
yes, it has,
workout
it seems
body.
To go from that model body to the kind of, you know, strong, right. strong, and fitness models.
Absolutely.
Which I think in some ways can be as damaging in terms of unrealistic expectations. I'm joined this afternoon in the studio by Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist. Thank you, Dr. Thuraya. And it's UK Children's Mental Health Week. So we are talking about the issues faced by an overwhelming number of children and young people. We were talking earlier about anorexia and what a cause for concern it is and has increasingly become. I've actually had an SMS anonymous come in. If you do not want to put your name on anything, of course, not a problem at all. If you want to call anonymously, please, please do. Someone has written in saying, I suspect my teenage daughter is self-harming after seeing marks that she tried to hide from me. I found links on her computer to anorexia pages that worry me. I don't want to do an intervention and push her away. I just don't know why she'd do this. I thought we were a happy family. Wow.
Well, I think, you know, from the message towards the end of that, it sheds some light into the expectations that the mother has onto the family. When you say, I thought we were a happy family, in that moment, this is not about you. It's not about you or your husband or, you know, any other sibling, children that you have. This is about your daughter, and your daughter seems to be suffering with something, and she's experiencing something extremely difficult that she felt she couldn't share with you and your husband. And she, you know, she's trying to express herself or deal with it with maladaptive coping strategies such as self-harming or restricting her food intake and maybe possibly having anorexia. One of the things that I would suggest is to try to speak to her, but not in a, like you said, in an intervention way, but to just try to talk to her and see how she's feeling as a whole and see if there's anything that you can do to help, or maybe even suggest that she talks to somebody else other than you, because if she's gets the sense that, you know, you may not necessarily appreciate the fact that she's doing this because you feel like she's breaking the happy family that you're considering, it might be a good idea for her to talk to somebody else until she feels comfortable enough to talk to you. But definitely address the topic, and And like I said before, I think with the previous message, build a relationship with your child first before you can talk to them about these very sensitive topics. And don't push, because ultimately, like, children are already very embarrassed and very ashamed when they are self-harming and they're trying to hide it from people. They're not doing it for attention by, like, just showing people. She's been trying to hide it, which means she's not happy with what she's doing, but she doesn't know how to handle her feelings otherwise.
Can you just explain to anybody about self-harm and the psychology behind that? Because I think a lot of people don't understand it at all.
Yeah, so self-harm is very, very different than the intent to hurt themselves finally. So it's not one of those kind of situations. It's really they're experiencing such emotional pain that they don't know how to handle it. And so what they do is that they physically harm themselves in order to release some of the emotional pain that they're going through. And it's not done out of attention seeking, and it's not done, you know, because they want people to like find out. It's really just something that they do for themselves because they're so overwhelmed with their emotions that they don't know how to deal with it in that moment. Now, this is not to say that there aren't a few individuals that will do it out of attention seeking. Yes, there are. However, the majority of individuals who self-harm are not doing it for attention seeking at all.
Okay, I hope that really helps. We've had another message come in saying, my 15-year-old daughter is about to take her GCSEs and is a true nightmare. Horrible to me, door slamming, rude, both to myself and her stepdad, and generally hideous, her words. She said that she is intentionally ignoring me to teach me a lesson because I wouldn't let her have a party when I was away. Teenage behaviour or something more, Dr. Thryer?
Well, I mean, from this kind of a message, it could sound easily like teenage behaviour, but ultimately there's a lot more here, I think, because a child doesn't go from being very polite and very kind and very caring to all of a sudden just, you know, hideous and door slamming and you know, being verbally abusive towards a mother. So there needs to be something in the middle there. And it might be important, maybe, I mean, you mentioned that there's a stepfather there. So when did this happen? How long ago was it? So there's so much more information that is needed to truly understand. Yes, it could be a part of a teenager rebellion thing, but teenagers don't usually shift from black to white so quickly.
Okay. And hormones, is that worth mentioning?
You mean for teenage years?
Well, all through the ages.
I would say yes. All through the ages, to be honest, because like ultimately, you know, when a woman gets pregnant, her hormones all over the place and she can be very moody, yeah, you know,
ask,
if you will.
Ask my husband.
Yeah. And even menopause, even andropause for men, what is better known as a midlife crisis for them. But I mean, all hormones will dictate a lot of our mood swings. And that is natural for any age at any moment in time. But definitely around the pubescent time, hormones are really just trying to regulate. So things can be a little bit up and down, but that usually will start around the time of them hitting puberty rather than 15 and into the 15 years age.
I think the exam aspect could be really crucial as well, in the sense, as you talked earlier, about this mounting pressure from both schools and perhaps parents as well. So what would you say then as a first port of call to helping this mum deal with her teenager?
Well, one of the things I would say is, first of all, I would want to know, why was it so important for her to have a party in the house? And why? I mean, sometimes children, you know, will surprise you with their answers. So maybe she's 15 and she's being pressured at school, or maybe all of her other friends had parties at home and their parents didn't mind, and now she feels like she's going to be left out and she's being bullied. There's so many different reasons. I would try to find out, go deeper into what's going on with your 15-year-old. I mean, ultimately, children don't react that way, especially teenagers don't react that way at their other stages when this situation hasn't happened. They're not usually in that state of mind. So why was this so important to her? And why was it also important to her for her to have the party when you were away? So there are other things that could be there that need exploring.
We're actually joined on the phone. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you doing? Good afternoon.
I'm well, thank you. Can you share a little bit about your experiences, please?
Yeah, so I come from a middle class family. And from a small age, not in small part due to my speech impediment, there was a lot of unpleasantness that I'd faced at school and at home. I used to get a lot of abuse from my dad, and there was a lot of talk at home about the forced concept of being happy. Now, no matter how much abuse I felt, I was always forced to feel that this was normal and that I'm supposed to be happy with this. But at some point, only after I became an adult, did I find out that this is not okay.
Dr. Soraya, can you shed any light onto this? Thank you for coming on the phone.
Well, first of all, I want to say, it's so brave for you to talk to us about this, because, you know, it's not easy to really look back at your family and sort of say, well, you know, what they did was wrong. It sort of breaks that bubble that we hope that our family members are always treating us in the best way possible. But that idea, that pressure to be happy all the time, and I hear that from so many of my clients as well, not just teenagers, but even adults, this fake sense of we have to be smiling and we have to be okay and everything needs to be good every single day. You know, sometimes my clients will come in and will say things like, this week wasn't a great week, you know, I think there's something wrong, maybe I should be on medication. I say, well, how many days out of the seven did you not have a good, you know, a good day or a happy day, like you're saying? And they'll say, well, you know, one or two. And I'll say, out of seven? And they say, yeah. And I say, well, hold on a second. That's really good. That's 5 out of 7 days that are amazing days. And they're like, yeah, but still, there's one or two days that are not good. And so that sense of that pressure that we've been getting from either society, from parents, from that social stigma of, oh my God, if you're sad, then you must be depressed. You know, all of these things are pressuring us to be happy when really life is, it has to be ups and downs, because if we're not feeling the downs, we don't know how to appreciate the ups, and we don't know how to get through the downs. So really what you're saying is so powerful, because truly it's one of the most important lessons that people need to learn, is that it's okay to be sad sometimes, and it's okay to be upset, and it's okay to be irritated, and it's okay to not like somebody sometimes. And, you know, it's okay to have negative emotions, because that's part of being human.
Yes, that is exactly. I just really want this message to be shared a lot more, because there's so many of my friends even that are just happy with being unhappy, which is not an emotion that I encourage at all. Like, people should realize that at some point in life, you need to seek help if you cannot feel happy, and, you know, live a happy life at some point in life.
Absolutely. And honestly, you know, it's one of the most bravest, you know, the stigma behind mental health is, you know, if you go to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, then you're weak. But I truly believe that is by far the strongest aspect in any human being when you ask someone for help. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but when you recognize that there's something going on that you need help with, asking for help takes a lot more strength and bravery and courage than just pretending that everything's okay.
Yeah, thank you. That actually means a lot to me, because even in my family at this point, even though my mom tries to understand me, there's still a lot of misunderstanding that takes place in between us. There's so much of, you know, God will help you, and not so much of you need to see a psychologist more. So I just really want everyone to understand that it's okay to seek help when you're going through stuff like this. I have friends who have intense anxiety, and they just don't see a professional, because they think that it makes them weak among other friends. And for that same reason, I haven't shared so much about me going to a doc to my other friends. And I just really hope at some point that this stigma will die down, and more people will appreciate the fact that, you know, we need help. This is something that everyone needs help with. If you're sick, if you have a cough, or if you have the flu, you go see a doctor and they help you out. This is just one of those things. You cannot help it.
Absolutely. Honestly, like, I really hope your family members and friends either are hearing this now or will hear it later. But what you're saying is so right and so, I mean, powerful. That's the word. I'm almost speechless, because, like, what you're saying is so powerful. Really, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. And I'm really glad you're getting the help that you need. Have a great afternoon. Wow, a really courageous call there. If you'd like any advice or just to share your experiences here on the Couch, please do get in touch. You can text us on 4001 or give us a call on 04-423-1010. We're here live in the Dubai Eye studio until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Joining me is Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist who's based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, working with teenagers. We've been talking a lot about children's mental health this afternoon so far. It's a week in the UK that really recognises this, and it's a very, very important topic to remove that stigma, to get the conversation going, both as parents, but also to talk to our children about emotions that they might be going through. Dr. Rai, thank you for joining us this afternoon. You specialise in teenagers. Do you have any groups or anything that you could sign as specifically helping teenagers with at the moment at the clinic?
Yes. Yeah, so what we do is that we have groups running throughout the year on things like anxiety, self-esteem, self-confidence. We do workshops on social anxiety as well, and depression and eating disorders and things like that.
So if you've got any questions, please do get in touch, 4001. Or you can call us on 04-423-1010. Quick reminder on our competition this afternoon, we've got lots of text messages coming in. You can win 500 dirhams to spend on food and drink, the Nippon Bottle Company, that's based at the Dusit Thani, Dubai. It's hidden behind a fake bookcase off the lobby, and you might even be asked to become a member. Sunday night is ladies' night, tonight is gents' night at the Nippon Bottle Company. So if you'd like to win 500 dirhams to spend, just send us a little SMS, 4001, with your name and the word Nippon, N-I-P-P-O-N. Or you can get in touch by the Dubai Eye Messenger app. We're also talking about grief this afternoon, Dr. Thuraya. Something I hear time and time again is grief is the price we pay for love. And I think everybody has been touched by grief at some point in their life, some to huge, devastating degrees, and some not so. And it's a huge, important, difficult topic. And I want to ask you, first of all, by asking, why are we so bad about talking about grief?
I think a big part of it is that it reminds us of our own mortality. And it reminds us that we are just as susceptible to not being here as the person who has left us, you know? And so when we talk about grief, or when we talk about the deceased, we tend to feel very discomforted, because it reminds us of the idea of death, and nobody truly likes to discuss that topic, because, you know, on some level we like to protect that sense of, you know, I teach my students this about the protecting our ego, and not ego as in pride, but ego as in like our sense of self. We have to protect that in thinking that we will continue to exist. And so the thought, the reminder that there will be a point where we will no longer exist is very scary.
Very jarring. We hear a lot about the five stages of grief. Can you just talk us through those?
Of course. So so one of the major theories behind behind grief are the five stages of grief that were introduced in 1969 by the psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she discussed the five different stages, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Now, this is not a linear...
Because I think that's the kind of understanding that, okay, I'm in the denial stage now.
Right.
Oh, okay, I'm getting on to bargaining. Oh, so it doesn't always happen in that order.
Absolutely not. A lot of people think that that's how it happens. It starts with denial and it ends with acceptance. That's actually not the case. Sometimes this could be like a loop that just continues, and it's not something that has to go from denial to anger, to bargaining, to depression, to acceptance. It could be denial to acceptance, and then you go back to depression, then you jump to anger, and then you go back, then you go to bargaining. So it's really just if you look at it drawn out, it's just a mess in terms of like the actual arrows towards each other. But to go through the stages, so denial is basically, it's really our body's defense mechanism. In that moment when we hear the shocking news and all of the emotions that come up in that moment. So our body has to deal with that overwhelming feeling. And usually that denial is very important for us because it protects us and allows us to process the information a little bit longer. Moving into anger, though, this is where you'll feel the feelings and the pain that comes from losing somebody is so overwhelming that you start to feel it in a way that is not, well, we want to say not productive, in the sense that you're not crying or you're not processing. You're more like it's the anger, and it could be towards objects, it could be towards family members, it could be toward people, it just could be toward yourself. It's just a lot of like
misplaced
frustration.
Emotion and yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Then you move into bargaining, which is that thought pattern of, if I had done this, you know, would they still be here? If I had done that, if I had prayed more, if I had thought of this, or, you know, those kind of thought patterns. And then the depression itself is, this is where sadness follows. And it's really, there are two types. You have the type that is sort of hidden. And then you have the depression that's really outward that people can see, where people are isolating and they're not talking to individuals and things like that. And then finally, there's that acceptance. And by acceptance, it's not that, you know, the person has been forgotten.
No.
It's just the acceptance of this has
happened.
This is the reality of the situation right now.
And what about the four stages of grief? This is another theory.
Yes. So this other theory actually came out a little bit later, and it really comprises the same five stages of Kubler-Ross. But this was done by Parks and Bowlby, and it talks about like the shock and the numbness in the initial stages, which is essentially what Kubler-Ross defines as denial. And then it turns into yearning and searching, which is really looking for that person, like wishing that they were around, wishing that you could talk to them one more time, wishing that you could. And that's that bargaining, a little bit of that bargaining stage with Kubler-Ross. There's the disorganization and despair. So this is where the grieving person really desires to withdraw and disengage from people around them. So this is more like the depression phase for Kubler-Ross, and even sometimes anger in the disorganization. And then finally, there's that reorganization recovery phase, where this is the more acceptance phase that people go through.
I think it's really important to acknowledge that there's no correct, no right or wrong way to grieve. People experience it in such different ways. I've even heard people about just shutting down completely and pretending, you know, upon the death of a close person that hasn't happened at all. Actually, my grandmother died 3 days before my first daughter was born, and I didn't physically have the headspace to deal with it at that time. What if people decide to do that, to really just shut it out and pretend it hasn't happened? What can the implications be there?
Well, actually, that happens for a lot of individuals when, especially around the time that there's something major that's happening in their life, because it's too overwhelming. And again, this is our body's defense mechanism to protecting us. So in that moment, it's okay if that happens. So, you know, unfortunately, with a lot of words that are really crucial in psychology, people look at it from a negative connotation. So when you think of the word denial, you think that, oh, this person's in denial, you know, they should be more accepting, things like that. But that's not the case. Denial is actually a really good defense mechanism in the moment that we need it. And in that moment, for you, for instance, you needed it. You needed to shut down those emotions because it would have been too overwhelming to deal with all of those things at the same time. And so the implication is, if you go back and revisit those emotions, actually, it won't be so. It'll actually be pretty functional, and you'll be able to process all of those feelings. It's only if you don't go back, that's where the implications are quite negative.
And what could happen then?
So you can suffer from things like depression. You can suffer from things like, you can go through anger outbursts and not really knowing why. And that's like the displaced anger itself. As well as other things, anxiety of death in general can come up for you. So there are a lot of implications. It just depends on the person. Also depends on the age. So younger children, you'll realize that they get very angry when they're not really processing their feelings of grief.
NASA is joining us on the line. Good afternoon, NASA.
Good afternoon.
Hi, NASA. How can we help you? Or more specifically, how can Dr. Thuraya help you this afternoon?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Thuraya, for the great show. I have a son in college in the U.S., and he is an introvert, and he's a great kid. And finally, after long years, he came out of his shell, and he told us that he has an issue in the mornings where, basically, I read about it, and it seems like a morning depression. And I'm trying to get him to go see a psychiatrist, but he is resisting. And I'm not trying to pressure him so he will not go back into his shell. I would appreciate it if you help me in suggesting a way to have him see a psychiatrist and seek some help.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Nasa, for that information. What I would suggest in this case, because he's in the U.S. in a college, usually when you suggest psychiatrists, people can get quite scared because the name holds a lot of fear and stigma into, you know, mental health diseases or disorders. And people can get very scared when you mention the word psychiatrist. But in the U.S., I know that a lot of the colleges have counselors at the school. And it might be a little bit more, I mean, he might be more convinced if you ask him to see a counselor, like a school counselor, like the college counselor, just to see if there's anything that she can suggest that he does in the morning to help him work through his feelings, either of depression or whatever he's going through in the morning. However, if he's still resisting that, I would like to know what is it that he's scared of. And I think a lot of people, when they think of visiting somebody and opening up to someone, they're either worried about their information being confidential or they're worried about being judged. And so finding the root cause as to what is it that's stopping him might be very essential to getting him to actually go see somebody. But the fact that he actually came out of his shell and he told you, I think that's such a big step, and recognizing that and telling him, you know, that must have been the hardest thing for you because, you know, you've always been that type of introverted individual. So I don't want to just take this information and then pretend that you never said it to me, to really like emphasize that, you know, that you appreciate how important this information was. And so telling him that he obviously told you for a reason. And so that reason may not be, consciously aware to him yet, but that you will be by his side and you'll be able to support him. And sometimes hearing that might make an individual feel a lot more comfortable to talk to somebody else because they've had a positive response from the first person that they opened up to.
Does that help, Ms. Nasser?
Yeah, that will help. Thank you very much. I think that that will be a good start, and I hope it will work. I think he's in little denial, but hopefully that will trigger a solution here.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Thurai, we're talking about grief and the stages of grief. I wanted to ask you, is there a difference if it's been a sudden death or a long illness in terms of how people react? We've a little clip now from Sheryl Sandberg, whose husband sadly passed away very suddenly in 2015. She's here, CEO of Facebook, talking about Option B, her book that she's written as a result of this.
My husband died suddenly. And it's an unimaginable thing to live through. I felt like there was a void closing in on me. I wouldn't be able to breathe. And above all, I really worried that my kid's happiness would have just been wiped out in that instant we lost Dave. And so I turned to my friend Adam Grant, who's a psychologist, and I said, what do I do? What do I do to get myself through this, get my kids through this? And what he taught me was that we're not born with a fixed amount of resilience. It's a muscle everyone can build. A few weeks later, I was talking to my friend Phil about a father-son activity that Dave wasn't going to be here to do. And we came up with a plan to fill in for Dave. But then I said, but I want Dave. I want Dave to go. And he said, option A is not available. So let's just kick the out of option B. And we all live some form of option B. You've lived through cancer. People go to prison. People lose jobs. People get divorced. People suffer unbearable loss.
That was Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, talking about Option B, her book, and how she began to deal with the loss of her husband very suddenly a couple of years ago. So my question, Dr. Thurai, is there a difference between how we deal with grief if there's been a sudden death or a long illness or a long prognosis?
Actually, between the expected or the unexpected grief, people go through the exact same stages. The only difference is with those that expect the grief to happen or the loss to happen, they tend to be able to express their emotions towards their loved one before passing happens. So there's a sense of relief and release that they're able to do before one passes away. Whereas when it's unexpected, a lot of people feel there was so much that wasn't said. There was so much that could have been done.
So it's grieving not only for that person, but grieving for the experience that they wish they'd been able to have.
Exactly.
With them. And also with a long illness, often it can be a series of tiny deaths in the run up to them actually passing, as the quality of life, you know, goes down, and It's a scientific thing as well. Hey, how does the brain react to that, to that kind of shock, to that kind of sudden takeaway?
Well, I mean, the brain reacts in many different ways, but one of the things that's really evident is that our brain tends to kick into high gear when it comes to the emotional, the overwhelming emotional effects that it has once we experience loss. And in that sense, there's you know, I'm trying to explain it without going too detailed into the neurobiology, but really it's like the brain is trying to heal itself in the moment, but it can't, because while it's tackling one part of it, there's another part of it that's feeling something else, and it's feeling very overwhelmed. So it's almost like, you know, looking at a cartoon who's like constantly like trying to
chaos.
Just absolute chaos. And so that's really what's happening within the brain when somebody's experiencing a loss. And also with the expected loss, there's that guilt as well that's added when there's a feeling of relief, you know, for the individual, either because they were their caretaker for such a long time and it had been so difficult to take care of them, or because you feel relief that the person's no longer suffering. And then there's that sense of guilt, like, how could I feel relief? And, you know, so there's that added factor that's a little bit different from the unexpected loss as well.
We do have a caller.
Hi, good afternoon, Helen.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure. How can we help?
I've personally have, you know, I've had a not so pleasant childhood, and it's maybe a little too late, but I'm now in my, you know, late 40s, and I can attribute some of the things that I'm dealing with probably to you know, that part of my life. What is troubling me now, and I've been dealing with, you know, for the past probably 20 years, is a severe depression related to work. Now, I've done fairly well. I've had good opportunities. I still have a very good job, but I find it really difficult for me to go to work. Could there possibly be a relation to, you know, to the life that I've had, and if so, what can I do about it?
Yes. Hi. I think what I'd like to know a little bit more about is, when you say it's very difficult for you to go to work, what do you mean by that?
I mean, getting up from the bed and making me go to work is something that I struggle with every day. Nothing unpleasant happens at work, but I don't know what's causing this. The only thing, like I said, the only thing I can possibly attribute it to is my not so happy, you know, life that I had.
Do you have the same feeling on the weekends as well, or is it just on your work week?
No, on the weekends I wake up early. I'm a very happy person. Come, you know, Saturday night I have the blues, and you know, it's difficult, and it's been 25 years that I've been dealing with this thing day in, day out.
So it does sound that like it could be related to the childhood difficulties that you had experienced, but without proper information or like deeper information, it's very hard to tell. So what I would suggest is maybe to, have you considered speaking to a psychologist or a counselor?
This is the first time I'm opening up, so no, I haven't.
Okay. So I mean, you know, a lot of people find it very difficult to open up and to share, but you have definitely taken the first and the most complicated and difficult step by opening up here. So if you find that you want to continue, I definitely would suggest that you speak to a psychologist about this, because once you're able to really tie in where a lot of these difficulties are coming from and this difficulty waking up and going to work comes from, then you can definitely work towards minimizing those kinds of feelings in the morning and having them affect your day-to-day.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much for coming on. A really courageous call, and as Dr. Thryer said, hopefully the first step on getting you feeling as you should. Have a great afternoon. Thank you. Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist, is with us here on Dubai Eye, on the couch until 2 o'clock. You can text in 4001 or give us a call 04-423-1010. We do have another caller on the phone. Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. On the subject of losing someone close, but, you know, witnessing their death slowly because of an illness, I do have a personal experience because I've actually seen my mother, you know, dying very slowly of an illness, and I had to care for her for a long, long time, for almost 9 years. What that did eventually is, as Dr. Thuraya mentioned, first, I have feelings of guilt because I did, at a certain point, feel a bit of relief because she was suffering. So her death was a relief for her. Of course, I miss her a lot, but ever since that happened, it has actually affected my outlook on life.
In what way?
I don't care anymore about many things in life, you know, the material things. I don't have any attachment to anything anymore, and not even to people. You know, I just like a way of protecting myself against losing the people I love one more time. So I'm kind of detached in the way I deal with people, especially when it comes to relationships. And I can detach myself very easily, and that has caused a lot of problems to actually commit to a relationship. When it comes to a job, I'm passionate about what I do, but at the same time, I don't feel like I want to really work so hard because, you know, I don't see a long term. I'm not able to see a future, a bright future in anything. Do you get my point? I don't know how to explain it. But the question is that a normal feeling for people who have witnessed death very slowly? And how do you think that could be, so I don't know, addressed?
I just want to thank you for coming on and opening up about this, and obviously offer our sympathies for the losses that you've suffered. Dr. Thuraya, can you, in terms of reaction to grief, can you offer any insights on this, please?
Well, you know, obviously, like she said, she's she was, you know, you were taking care of your mom for 9 years. I mean, that kind of day in and day out watching your mom suffer with an illness and then slowly, you know, deteriorate until she passed away, that must have been very difficult for you. And that kind of overwhelming consistent feeling needs to be protected by the body, and it needs to be protected by the brain. And so what usually happens is that people become desensitized, they become detached from the reality that's around them because they need to, you know, stay strong and work through it for their loved one. So it's extremely natural for you to have these feelings, but definitely you're going to need to process these emotions because of the fact that the more you detach and the more you protect yourself from creating any kind of attachment or care towards something else out of the fear of losing it, it'll isolate you more and more, and then can lead into, developing major depressive disorder or anything like that. So it's important for you to speak to somebody about these feelings that you've been having. And it's like we talked about when it came to grief, when it comes to grief, Helen, there is no set time that you're allowed to grieve or not allowed to grieve. You take the time that you need, but just get the help that you need in order to process all those feelings properly.
I really hope that helps. And Dr. Thuraya is at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, and her team there are obviously very capable. So please do reach out. You've done it already by getting in touch with the show this afternoon, and I really hope you can go on to create some meaningful relationships and get a little bit more happiness back in your life.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ken has been on the text line saying, "My dad died suddenly last year without me seeing or speaking to him before he passed. Not saying goodbye pains almost as much as the loss. The fond memories luckily have got me through, and I encourage anyone to lean on their memories for strength. And I think that's exactly it. We talk, it's a cliche about, you know, he lives on in my memories, but that's actually very true. And moving on isn't, as you said earlier, about forgetting. It's, you know, love and loss can very much live alongside each other in your heart. We've had a message here saying, I get very high heartbeats to the point I faint sometimes whenever I get mad, mostly at work. Small things make me so nervous for no reason. Sometimes I have to leave work and go home. Could it be something which has a root in depression? Is it normal to be this way? Dr. Thry, can you shed any light?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the word normal to begin with, because I don't know what that is. But what I can say is that it's not functional and it's not helping you. So definitely it's not it's something that you want to look into. And yes, it could have a root in depression, because anger, all psychologists know that anger is not a primary emotion, it's a secondary emotion. The primary emotion, or for instance, to understand it a little bit more, it's a reaction to an emotion, and usually the emotion is pain or hurt. And so for men, for instance, they show their depression through anger and irritability, and so not the same way as most women would. Now, in this case, if you feel like there's a lot of anger and it's mostly at work, that means there's also something that's affecting you at work. Identifying what that is, learning proper coping strategies would be very helpful to minimize this kind of reaction.
We've got Ira joining us. Good afternoon, Ira. How can we help?
Yeah, very good afternoon to you, dear. And good afternoon to Dr. Teresa as well.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Okay.
I understand it's not you, it's your brother that you've got some concerns about.
Yeah, it's
about.
In regards for my brother. I won't take much. It's a short brief. It's in regard about his behavior and his emotions these days. Basically, he's a very, you know, maintained guy since his childhood. He's 25 now, but he's been, you know, start getting anger day by day increasing, and it affecting our family business as well. He's reacting more than he's been adapting things. So my question in a short brief is, do I have to take him to the psychiatrist to, you know, get control his anger and emotions rather than reacting and adapting things?
Well, you know, before actually taking him to see a psychiatrist, I think it would be beneficial for you to talk to him first, because like mm-hmm. I had mentioned just a little bit earlier, that you know, for men, when they're feeling depressed, they actually show that depression and anger. So it's important to maybe have a sit down with him, talk to him about his changes in mood, his increased anger, increased irritability, and see if there's something that's bothering him. Because you don't always have to jump to the psychiatrist or the psychologist. Sometimes having the conversation at home might be helpful. Now, if he doesn't feel like he can open up, this is a good time to say, you know, let's go talk to somebody that might be able to help you.
Because the problem is that, doctor, he's like, you know, he's lack of words. He never talked to anyone. He have very, you know, limited friends as well, two or three who's been since his childhood. Every time I ask him to, you know, build up his network, even though it's a family business, he do work, but now it's affecting our business. Whenever I said anything to him, he don't listen, and he start getting, you know, yelling, shouting, and he's thinking that he's correct every time. It's not that I'm not wrong, like correct every time. I also wrong sometimes. But he never listened. That's the question right now. Because I said before he listened to me, talked to me, and right now I've been very upset about his behavior to in office as well. Because it's not good impression to our staff when me and him, you know, we've been yelling each other in office.
No, of so course. I mean, that can be productive for either one of you. But I think it might also be important for you to put your feelings aside in the moment that you decide to talk to him. Because if you're coming at him angry and offensive, what ends up happening is that he's going to be very defensive and he's not going to want to open up to that. So it's
correct.
Important to maybe talk to him more like a sister rather than a business owner, rather than a, you know,
no,
don't worry about that right now.
Me and him. Correct. All righty. That's I think so is the best. Do you tell me like any like sort of particular, do I have to talk initial about that, or just talk what exactly in his heart?
I think it would be good to just ask him what's been going on, because there's something that's changed in his behavior. So maybe it's important to ask him what's made him adjust this behavior. What's affecting him to the point where he's obviously not in a good place.
Okay. Correct. Thank you so very much,
Ira. Thank you for joining us on the couch.
Take care.
We've had quite a few text messages coming in, so we'll do as many as we can, Dr. Thryer. I guess you get this question a lot. I'm a heavy smoker and I hate it. I've tried patches, would make me feel ill. My habit depresses me and it's affecting my marriage. Could psychotherapy or hypnotism work?
They could, but I would actually start with something a little bit cheaper, which is it's a book by Alan Carr. It's called Stop Smoking, or The Easiest Ways to Stop Smoking. It's actually a great book. I've read it myself. It helped me stop smoking as well.
Well, there you go.
But and a few people that I know. So I would suggest maybe start there. And if that doesn't work, then yes, hypnotherapy or even psychotherapy might be helpful.
Okay. An anonymous text saying, thank you for the show. What about, we've been talking about grief this afternoon. What about that constant worry of losing those we love? It makes me sad just for the thought of the possibility of losing them.
I mean, obviously, for most people, the thought of losing a loved one is quite intense, and nobody wants to think of that. And it could really be nerve-wracking and even anxiety-provoking. However, to better prepare yourself, and nobody can truly be prepared when you suffer a loss of a loved one, but to accept the fact that on some level we are all going to pass away and we are all going to die, and that death is inevitable. However, we can make the best of the time that we have. And so instead of it's basically shifting your focus from worrying about your loved one's passing to more of a focus on what can I do with them to make the time that we have together more memorable, and that I could hold on to these memories for the rest of my life.
So a change in mindset. If it's a bigger worry, worth seeking help to talk about why you have those worries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking personally, after I had my first child, I think something changed in me where I became super anxious about protecting my baby and very worried about that. And I think that's quite a common thing in new mums as well. So if anyone else is listening, certainly not alone on that. We've been joined this afternoon by Dr. Thryer. She's a clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. So on the couch, we're here every Wednesday talking about mental health issues. Dr. Thryer, thank you so much for all of your wisdom and advice this afternoon.
No problem. Thank you, Helen.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.